By the time Beethoven arrived on the musical scene, composers were known for their work, meaning you could look at previous centuries when classical composers wrote anonymously, and the works were very often for the church. So once composers got to put their names on their musical compositions, they started caring more about their product and how it would be viewed and how it would be played after they were dead. One of the obvious byproducts was the details became refined. So the language of expression, specifically dynamics, tempo, and articulation, they grew in meaning. Composers were very interested in the way their music would live on, especially how their music would be played after they themselves passed on. In the case of Beethoven, musicians are exploring the composer's scores because it's believed that copyists and engravers may have left out some of his markings. Welcome back to Accelerando. I'm Paula Tuttle, and this week we're joined by the Bayeux String Quartet's violist, Sean Newcomb. Sean is the violist and the instigator of the quartet. He and his brother Jason started the quartet 10 years ago, and Bayeux has found a path that embraces supporting young composers, bringing concerts to schools and festivals, and playing styles adjacent and not so adjacent to classical music. They're known for their experimental performances, including a heavy metal work they wrote called Triggerland, and that won Sean some awards at film festivals. Today I'm asking Sean to join me as we look into a movement they'll play next week at Bar Marco, the third movement of Beethoven's 15th string quartet. So Sean, you said that your quartet played this Opus 132 a dozen times?
Yeah, it must have been 10 or 12 times last season. And I think it's, well, we're playing it in a week and a half here in Pittsburgh, and maybe once or twice and throughout the next season. I mean, we'll program it wherever we can. We're shameless. We love it.
I know you recorded Opus 131, so I'm getting them a little mixed up. I was surprised. Oh, 132. You're not doing them in order or anything. They're just...
Nope. And this next season we're doing 59, number 3. And two seasons ago we did some Opus 18. Our goal is to work through all of the Beethoven because we just love them. We want to actually spread them out and not go in order so we can get in tow with his younger self in the middle and all of that stuff. So, you know, they're Opus 131 and 32, but they were actually written in the reverse order. And I think it's really actually clear when you sit and look at the form of each of them, because 131 goes a little bit more out of the box in terms of what he's doing with each movements and the seven movements and how they, it's almost a continuous piece. So you can see the seeds, I think, in 132 for where 131 goes, even though the opus number is earlier, it was written after. And there's a lot of information that he took from one to the other, and it's just, you can get a sense of that, I think.
I saw that he wrote, the sequence was 12, 15, 13, 14, and 16, but 15 and 13 were written pretty much simultaneously. Like, that's some of the minutia that really doesn't mean a whole lot to us as musicians, except for when you say, I can see what they were writing here corresponds with something he wrote there. That is interesting. But when they were actually published, maybe the publisher got them in the wrong order and nobody cares. I don't know.
Well, there's got to be some business there. They know that one is going to be more popular than the other and they want to start strong. Just like nowadays, an album, you put your first single, usually your first track, to get a good going. I've always thought that the journey of being a musician when I'm a kid, I'm really into how to play one note and then a bar and then a phrase and then a movement and then a full piece. And, you know, now 41, when we're working on a work, a Debussy, be it or whatever composer, I'm really interested. I want to know what their surrounding decade of their life is like, because it absolutely influences what a marking might be on a page or not, or what their frame of reference or context is coming from. So for me, the Beethoven, it's interesting to know what they were published or when they were published, but it really changed our approach in the quartet and to how we might interpret it, knowing when it was actually written, which might seem like small potatoes, and maybe that's romanticizing it a little, but we feel we get something from it, so therefore it's, I think, worthwhile for us anyway.
Absolutely. You connect to the composer and what they were thinking, but there's also the thought that when Beethoven came along, he started putting, you know, the big movement at the end, you know, especially in his later works. And certainly this piece that we're talking about today, his Opus 132, I think we both feel like the third movement is the heart of the piece.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because here we are here today to talk mostly about that movement, because you said in one of your YouTube videos it's really biographical,
mm-hmm.
autobiographical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty uncharacteristic for Beethoven to go the autobiographical route, which makes it super interesting. One thing I always love about Beethoven is the content of the music is enough. There is enough happening there that when you walk away as a listener or a performer, that it's all right there. Whereas something that another composer might write, say, just to pick on Berlioz, even though I love him, that the Symphonie Fantastique, if you take away the story, is the music enough? Well, maybe I could see an argument for either way, but just to highlight the specialness from Beethoven's vantage, that he is using the autobiographical nature to tell the story. He had become very ill, so much so that he was getting his affairs in order, really thought he was knocking on death's door, and at the last minute made a turnaround and wrote this movement. And I think what's so moving about it is that it is written as presenting thankfulness and gratitude to the divine, the divinity, God, Lord, whatever you want to call it, for the sparing of his life. And even in that context, that takes a different tone than being thankful to be alive. It has just a slightly different tone.
What we see in this movement is there's a hymn that kind of develops throughout it in three sections, and then interspersed is a section in three. One person described it as a man or somebody just coming out of a sickness, just kind of hobbling along. And I don't know how you see how this fits into the autobiography of this movement.
Yeah, the construction of it, even the form, it's amazing. You're right. It's in five large sections. Parts 1, 3, and 5 are this imitative chorale-like material. Sections 2 and 4 are this B section that he calls it Neukraft, new strength. He literally writes it in there. It's this beautiful D major, a strong 3 feel, very ornamental in the first violin part, and it feels absolutely joyous. When performing it, it makes me think of the amount of joy I get when I see my boys in the morning. That level of sincere joy and gratitude of being. Nothing more, not for anything, just for being. And he captures that in the music.
Yeah, I believe that it does sound like he just is barely getting strength, but then there are a lot more fast notes later on in this that are ornamenting it, but it's not a really fast three. It's like he's just barely getting going.
Yeah, it feels very pillory, like there's these pillars of chords for each bar that are stated by the full quartet. 1, 2, 3, 1. To which, to me, feels like that strength, and beats 2 and 3 are very regimented as well. So there's a lot of verticality mixed with the ornamentation, which brings in this horizontal feel. And I think the new strength also shows itself in that I would argue that the A section feels a little less like Beethoven, which we can get into a little if you want, but the new strength sections feels more like him at himself. He'll introduce this idea, he embellishes it, and then he brings in some rhythmic interplay between the inner voices. You have 32nd notes being passed bum, 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 between the two different instruments, and it feels like, yes, this is Beethoven. I am myself again.
So you said on social media that you discovered that it has roots in Josquin.
Josquin des Prats, yeah, that's, yes. We did a presentation at a chamber music festival that we're in residence at. We did some talking and digging, and what we discovered really genuinely, genuinely blew our minds, that Beethoven very purposefully is reaching back in time to write the primary material. And it happens in a couple ways. One, first, the A section is a series of imitative counterpoint that is answered with a chorale. So that already has its feet in two ways in what happens before that. Josquin is an example of 1400s counterpoint. You can think of Palestrina, Gesualdo, any of these guys. Okay, so already using imitation in a very similar way, all in canonical entrances. But also the key he's writing, and it's in a Lydian mode. So this is another connection to this pre-18th century formal theory. Well, then he goes to this chorale section. This now ties into Bach. He does these amazing transformations where he has a chorale. And the chorale is the main thing, but then he writes new material to go with it. And that new material is of such interest that it becomes the primary material that's just held together and woven together by this chorale that's being done in almost double time over it. And Beethoven does this. In the first A section, you get imitation. Then you get the first statement of the chorale with the quartet just sits on these chords. And the whole first A section, this is all it is, back and forth between these two ideas. When this A section comes back, the first A prime section, the imitation is using different layers of counterpoint. There's more contrary motion, you have different movement happening, and then that also continues during the chorale itself. And then the last big section of the piece, the third statement of the A section, it's at its most elaborate level of counterpoint. It's similar to a fugue. It is the same idea of imitation followed by chorale, imitation followed by chorale, except that the contrapuntal material that is being used is woven in everywhere all the time. So it's never leaving that, and that creates anticipation and joy and all of this. And what's amazing that we discovered, and I need to give credit to John Remini for finding this, was that the chorale that he's using is almost note for note perfectly matched up with Bach's chorale 93. Bach's chorale 93 uses a melody that was written by Nicholas Selnecker in 1587. Bach harmonizes it in 1723. And this chorale 93, I have to read you the text from it. Well, first we have to say that for anyone that doesn't know, the third movement title is Holy Song of Thankfulness from a Convalescing Person to the Divine. That's the title he gives it. This chorale 93, that is almost note for note exactly the same chorale hymn that Beethoven uses in this third movement. The text for that is, "This night when the dark shadows have surrounded me completely, God was my defense." And you go on to read and realize this is a hymn of thanksgiving. This third movement of 132 is often referred to as the movement of thanksgiving. This is Beethoven in his gratitude and thankfulness, looking back at what's come before and using that to help weave this thankfulness in almost a sacred way, as much as he can anyway.
Beethoven is a master's master at this point in his life. It was 2 years before he died, and he's sensing his mortality. Is it a nod to mortality?
He doesn't quote Josquin, but the reason we brought Josquin into the presentation that we did was to show a very quick example of imitation in the style that Beethoven uses, that so that the technique of imitation gets used in a similar way. And I think Beethoven reaching back in time to counterpoint practices from the 1400s to this hymn that the melody is written in the 1500s to Bach styles that's written 100 years before Beethoven's writing this is a great example of how wonderful art exists not in a silo of when it was written. It exists The arrows of time that go backward and forward. Backward, drawing on what's come before, knowing why that music has survived, why it's been there, and moving forward by when we play Beethoven nowadays, it is not a museum piece. It is not preserving tradition, I think. It is presenting this music that has survived for a reason, and it takes on new life and new meaning for the listeners of today. And that it can still provide these amazing experiences is why it's genius.
Some musicians, like string players and quartets, have tried to get the actual manuscripts because they think that there are clues in it that never made it into the printed or engraved copies. And I wondered if you've looked at any of these manuscripts.
No, I haven't. We did a concert at Morgan Library in New York a year or so ago, and they had the original manuscript of Schubert's, I want to say it was The Erl King. And it changed it. Seeing it, knowing that this is a, so I could see that being a thing.
Yeah. So looking at Beethoven's manuscript for this third movement, here he was very ill, and he was also pretty deaf. The way he would write is he would take a pencil in his mouth and push it against the piano so when he played, he could feel the vibrations. And also the manuscript was really thick like rag paper so that he could scrape off any changes. So more than even his earlier scores, you can just see this such a chore for him. Because he was sick and he could barely make straight lines, so the stabs must have been terrible, you know. And people are saying that they're finding marks in there that you don't see anywhere. But Beethoven obviously really cared how people would play his music once he died. And we're talking about this piece where he was sensing his mortality. So he would write things in the score like FFMO. And people are trying to figure out what it means. And there are some other scores, like the Appassionato Sonata, he would write a line because he didn't know what else to write on a really pianissimo chord that was like a transitional harmony. And those things never made it into the engravings. The Borromeo Quartet has started performing from the scores. And I know some other people that did that. Do you guys do that?
I'll study the score thoroughly before rehearsals, but once I'm in a rehearsal, I no longer want to ever look at a score. And the reason is I want to use my ears as much as I possibly can, and I feel that if I have a score and I can see what someone else is playing, I am hearing with my eyes more or as much as my ears, and I want to just make sure that I am really giving as much attention as I can to what my colleague is playing and how they're playing it.
The music is not exactly what's on the page. It changes once you play it, you know, how it interacts. I mean, that gets back to what I was saying about Beethoven wanting to write another level of expression in his music that somehow never got put into his manuscripts. There is more. And if you are looking at the music, your eyes will always take over your ears because they're in front. Performing by memory is another example of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. It changes when you put the music in front of you.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does.
So you wrote a pop song based on the B section of this third movement. Did you struggle with that special chord that's like the surprise chord and how that fit into something as generic as pop music? Was pop limiting?
No, it was actually refreshing in the moment. You know, that whole pop song I think I wrote in probably about 15 minutes. So in the trying to get through it quickly as I can, and that chord getting there is refreshing. It's like, oh, thankfully, something colorful I can do something with. So these videos that I'm creating, they're speaking to a really specific demographic. It's not necessarily classical musicians. And so the idea is to combine all these ideas and how to bring them in to modern production in a way that doesn't belittle any party, any party being the producers and engineer side or the pop side of creators who aren't thinking in terms of formal structures that a trained classical musician might, but also not selling that side short either.
You show a picture of Beethoven, like his eyes getting bigger and bigger on the video.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's that's part of, I'm still learning to figure out the algorithm. Part of that is, I don't necessarily always buy the argument that, oh, we have shorter and shorter attention spans. I could see that that's probably been happening for millennia in different ways. But I do agree that with things like TikTok and other ways that it's so easy to consume so much information so quickly, there have to be ways to constantly be recapturing attention when you want to present something that's a little bit longer. That's, you know, I don't know if it's needed, but...
Eyes pop open at certain places, like you did what?
You did what? Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that the question of attention span, yeah, a lot of people, the attention span can be shortened and shortened, but there are a lot of people who are very curious out there, and they want content. And I really hope that your channel starts catching on, because I think there are people that are interested in that sort of thing. And you're bringing that to your audiences as well. You do a lot of educational things, and now you're playing at Bar Marco. You're playing this Opus 132.
My quartet, we're playing at Bar Marco. We decided we wanted to do a self-produced concert of music that we just love here in our hometown. And so we're doing a full concert. It's called Echoes of Life. And we thought that the three pieces that we've picked really show the gratitude of life in really quite different ways. The first piece we're playing is from my life, Smetana's First String Quartet, which is also autobiographical. Each movement really musically describes different aspects of his life, starting from his childhood all the way to essentially his death. It's an amazing work. Has some great viola moments. Not that that's why I pushed to play it, but
of course it is.
Then we're playing the piece of mine that I wrote that you've heard us play, Balcon, because that tells the story of life in a different way, about story about my mom. And then after intermission, we're playing 132 in its entirety.
It sounds like a great program. It does. El Balcon fits into any program. I've heard you play it twice.
That's right. That's right.
You played it at City of Asylum, and you played out in Ligonier.
Was it La Trobe maybe a year ago? That was the first, the premiere of that. That was the first performance in public anyway of that piece, I believe.
Right. So for Bar Marco, do people have to go to Eventbrite or something to get some tickets?
Nope. They can go directly to our website, balestringquartet.com, and they can get the tickets directly from us. I think there's a 10% discount buying them beforehand, or they can get them right at the door September 10th at 7:30 p.m. at Bar Marco. And we did a really cool project. We met with Shelby, who manages a lot of the stuff at Bar Marco. She spent a couple hours with us designing special drinks to pair with each of the pieces, where we really dove into the psychological aspects of each piece with her, and then did a bunch of sampling of different qualities of tastes to try and come up with a drink that really captured the essence of each piece, which was an absolute blast. We filmed it. People can see the promo videos of us doing that with Shelby. So at the concert, there'll be breaks to be able to, for someone who wants, to have a sample of different paired drinks with each of the pieces.
This might be one of the last times you perform it.
Certainly for a while. We'll definitely want to cycle it back in. But we very purposely wanted to program it here in Pittsburgh. So we're excited to get another go at it before we have all of our other rep for this season. It's an amazing piece. It's I don't know that I've ever had, for some of the best musical experiences I've ever had in my life is performing that work. That contrast of needing to have all of your mental faculty and physical faculty to deliver, yet you can't set the heart aside. You're absolutely tied to what the music is doing, and that juxtaposition of right brain and left brain, or brain and heart, that are needed to really bring it across. It was really unlike anything I have ever experienced in life. I've experienced in other pieces, but never to the extent that this movement requires, at least in my experience.
Join the Bayo Quartet members, Sean, Jason, Gio, and Ryan at Bar Marco on September 10th. You can purchase tickets on their webpage, bayostringquartet.com, or at the door. Please share this episode with someone you think will enjoy it, or bring the same friends to the concert. And as another reminder, you can subscribe to Accelerando on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere. That's it for this week. We'll see you next time. Bye now.